Embark on a journey with us where resilience meets opportunity. This is the Dirt Road to Success.
Hi, I'm Skip Colvin with Dirt Road to Success. Welcome back to the next show. We got a really good friend of mine here, Jason Koloski, the president and CEO of Watchtower Firearms. We're going to have a great conversation today about his storied career, all the things that he's done, especially going to talk a little bit about his wife, Casey, and how she's put up with him. But, man, it's going to be a great show today. I really look forward to it. Jason, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Skip. Thrilled to be here. Yep. Thanks for having me on.
I'm finally getting you, man. I've been wanting to get you on the show for a while, but I know you've been busy.
So, a couple things on the plate.
Yeah, just a little bit. So, you know, I kind of want to introduce you to our audience a little bit. And I know you've been on some other podcasts and really kind of had your story out there. But first thing foremost, you're from Louisiana.
Yep.
Okay.
Great state of.
That's right. That's right. A lot of my family's from Louisiana, so we're probably related somewhere down the line. But tell me a little bit about your story, where you came from, kind of where you started, and sure. we'll roll into it.
Sure. So grew up in a backwater of Louisiana, a little small town called Moss Bluff. So literally out of Central Casting. It could have been like Reese Witherspoon in Sweet Home Alabama.
I mean, so all my Moss Bluff friends need to watch this is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's about 50 of them. So.
And I know all of them.
We probably know all the same people. So, no, great place to grow up, but very small town, and a place that, you know, great to go back to, but not necessarily a lot of opportunity. So grew up there, ended up, my family has served in every conflict since World War II. So, grandfather's in the European theater during World War II, Pacific theater, island hopping. Both my dad and my uncle were Marines, Vietnam era. My uncle was at Khe Sanh. I was in the Marines. So it was a natural progression when I left Louisiana. Joined the Marines, ended up volunteering and somehow making it through the recon selection process. Deployed overseas, went to all the classic reconnaissance schools. And then from there, started kind of a whole new journey into, I'm a two-time winner, swamp creature. You know, I grew up in Louisiana, and then I spent the rest of my career in Washington, D.C. So working foreign military sales, working at the Pentagon, running some of the major regional offices, and ended up at Raytheon and eventually Watchtower.
Yeah. Let's rewind that.
Yeah, we
missed a lot of stuff. That's
right.
We can
unpack it all.
So first and foremost, thank you. Yep. Appreciate you and your family service. You know, a lot of my family served in the military as well. And my dad was in the World War II Pacific Corregidor.
Super impressive.
Captured at Corregidor, 42 months prison camp, Camp Fukaka in Japan. It was Camp 17 is what they called it, but it was in Fukaka. Worked coal mines, you know, got out. A prison camp when the war was over and stayed in the Marine Corps.
American.
Yeah. Just a lot of patriotism, brothers and all that stuff that served as well. So appreciate the service. What's interesting about your military career for obviously being in the recon,
community
package. Yep, yep. The community, but you went a couple of places.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
you want to talk a little bit about that, or we want to skip over Somalia?
We can jump into anything. So it's funny when you get into these conversations, especially as it revolves around being a recon Marine, it undoubtedly goes down all these tough guy roads.
Yeah.
And look, the guys that are in or that are recon Marines are in the special operations community broadly are a little bit different. They, by and large, regardless of what you see on podcasts, really shy away from getting into a lot of the hero talk about it all. Now, I know that's interesting for folks. I know they would like to hear those stories.
Yeah. But we call it door kicker talk.
Yeah. I always joke when it comes time, like, well, you know, what was your specialty? And my specialty was shallow water blackouts. I excelled at getting drowned during pre-scuba. So,
okay.
You know, you as you go through the selection process, people usually like to skip over that and just, you know, they were a hero and they did all this great stuff. But no, my specialty was shallow water blackouts. Mm-hmm. And then, we did a lot of interesting things, deployed to Africa. You mentioned Somalia, Rwanda. Mm-hmm. We were part of, the 15th MEU when, that we got parked off the coast. And, we also were in the Middle East for a while doing a number of interesting, interesting things.
Yeah.
But no, it's a time that, I loved. I've stayed in very close contact with everyone in that community. Still contribute to the Marine Reconnaissance Foundation on a regular basis. And we have a gathering every year. I've mentioned this to you. We head up to my place in West Virginia, and it's just kind of a soul rejuvenating moment. So being a Recon Marine has been a big part of my life, and it's a big part of my story. It's kind of a shoreline when things get tough. You know, SEALs always like to talk about buds. That's their thing. They love that. They love that song and dance routine.
And you hear that a lot, right?
I hear that every single day from my chief communications officer.
And just who is that special gentleman?
Oh, Ray Cashcare, former Navy SEAL. it just rolls off the tongue.
It just rolls off the tongue. So, Ray obviously is hilarious, but he's also a great, great patriot. And, great and American. I think a lot of him, I really do. Mm-hmm. But what's so funny is, you know, when I brought in my buddy to meet you guys, and we were talking everything else, and we leave, and he says, "Man, that guy's on fire." I'm like, "Yeah, Ray is. Ray's on fire, and he's powerful in his speeches. I love what he's doing. So no shade on him at all, man. And I'm telling you, he's freaking tough as nails."
Oh, we can throw shade on him. That's perfectly fine. No, it's perfectly fine.
I'll let you do that.
No, Ray is a good friend. He's a great leader. I love working with him. But where I was going, you know, it's you always kind of have a shoreline when things get tough.
Yeah.
It's, you know, one foot in front of the other. Mm-hmm. Keep, because you've done it before. You've done it to the point of hypothermia, shallow water blackout, just, you know, blood, sweat, and tears. So it's a good shoreline to always kind of connect with. And Ray definitely has that. That's something that I have and keeps us going when things are bad.
Yeah. Well, I like how you said it's just one foot in front of the other, especially, and we talked on this show a lot about mentors up and down. So someone who's been there before, and then someone that's not that yet there that you can bring along. And I think even in your probably military career, you've had those that have invested in you and taught you, hey, I know what you're about to go through. You've never gone through, but here's how you handle it. Right. Or you're telling the guy below you, hey, this is what's going to happen. And that's really that leadership up and down the org chart. And I think Ray does that a lot.
Yeah, he does that a lot. Matter of fact, he and I had a little counseling session with somebody yesterday, as a matter of fact, and he's excellent at it.
Yeah.
Excellent at it.
Well, the reason I brought up, you know, just your career in the Marine Corps, Somalia, things like that, is that it transitioned you to another step. Right. So what year did you get out of the Marine Corps?
So, got out, in 96, stayed in the reserves for another 2 years. But I basically got out. I enlisted, so I had 2 more years of college to wrap up. So got out, wrapped up that time that I needed to get my degree. Almost immediately went in and got my master's degree after that. And my wife and I were living up in Northern Virginia.
Mm-hmm. The rock star, Casey.
Rock star. She is Saint Rock Star. there's not enough superlatives I can give my wife for putting up with me. But we're in Northern Virginia and dabbled in a couple of different things, but ultimately... So I ran the Coast Guard's International Program Office.
Okay.
Which sounds a little funny because when you think of the Coast Guard, you're like what, like, are they in charge of life preservers? Like, how does that work? But it's interesting. So, when I say International Programs Office, what I'm talking about is FARA military sales. So what we sell to our allies and friendly countries overseas to help promote their security.
Mm-hmm. And what group was this with?
This is within the Coast Guard.
Okay.
So I was a senior civilian. The interesting thing is our Coast Guard, is a Marine or any other service, we like to pick on one another, but truly a phenomenal organization, right? And from a size comparison standpoint, on any given day, they're the fourth or fifth largest Navy in the world.
Wow.
So you have to remember is we don't sell carriers to anybody. We don't sell Aegis destroyers or any. Our Navy is in a Michael Jordan class. Mm-hmm. And you can, it's funny, you know, you can go on YouTube and you can find all these different comparisons and, oh, China's going to do this and that. Our Navy does not have a peer, period. End of conversation. Nothing left to talk about. Now, you can nitpick around the edges of that, but.
Good to hear that, by the way. As a patriot, I'm good to hear that.
Our Navy doesn't have a peer. It does not have a peer. End of conversation. We can always be better and we can have that type of conversation, but they don't have a peer. But from a part of, there's a number of reasons we do foreign military sales. One of the reasons is to ensure interoperability with our allies. So anytime we go into a fight, they have the same radios, they have the same aircraft, they have the same code signals, yada, yada, yada. So we can knit them in as a force multiplier. Well, when you can't really move surface combatants because we just outscale everyone, that becomes a problem. So the Coast Guard actually plays a pretty important role in that conversation at the national level because their frigates or their what they call national security cutters are essentially frigates. And those do sell to other countries as their capital vessels. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of training and interoperability that goes on with other navies of the world vis-a-vis our Coast Guard. So it was a very eye-opening experience to see how a truly, you know, great history, great organization, but somewhat belittled in the political dialogue of the country, how really important they are.
And so, they have some level of special operators even within the Coast Guard now, don't they?
Yeah, it's yes and no. And everybody loves the special operator terminology or operator, whatever what's in vogue at the moment. They're more of a law enforcement organization. Mm-hmm. That's really their heart and soul. They have their cultural pulls go back to Hamilton and the revenue cutters, the founding of the country. But their role is far more law enforcement and far less military. Mm-hmm. So it's a service that has a foot in kind of each camp.
Can get complicated though, too. Yeah,
get a little complicated.
But rules of engagement are different in both.
Very different in both. But they do have a group, to answer your question, that is does training with recon Marines, does training with the SEALs, a lot of maritime interdiction. A lot of the stuff they do is very high risk.
Yeah.
What you see them doing in the Gulf with a lot of these submarines that the cartels are building to bring drugs or human trafficking or whatever into the country. Those are the guys interdicting them. They're literally jumping on
I saw that video the other day.
Broke ass submarine.
I was like, holy crap, man, this guy's bad.
Yeah. It's like riding a bull at Gillies, it's with a gun.
Yeah. I mean, with a gun.
It's impressive. It's impressive.
In the ocean. Yeah. So, and that's exciting to hear that because, you know, you're right. A lot of people want to say or put shade on the Coast Guard, but in reality, they're the front line to a lot of things that's going on.
Oh yeah.
Especially the drug trade.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, human trafficking, drug trade, pretty much anything that, we're having challenges on our southern border with, they've been dealing with those same challenges in a maritime environment on our southern borders for decades.
Yeah.
So they're truly the unsung heroes, and I can't say enough positive things about it. But that time there was very instrumental, and my next step was I moved into the Navy's International Program Office. So Coast Guard, U.S. Marine Corps, and Navy foreign military sales. So, you know, we don't sell a lot of major surface combatants or any for that matter overseas from a U.S. Navy standpoint, but we do move a lot of F-18 Hornets. Mm-hmm. The Marines heavily involved in training all across the globe. And that's just not like recon and MARSOC. That's infantry units that go into other countries and train our allies and partners. And then the weapon systems that come along with the Marine Corps, those are often much like the Coast Guard. What the U.S. Marine Corps does is oftentimes far more compatible from a size perspective and a scope perspective with other armies.
Okay.
So, from a training standpoint, and anytime we want one of our allies to be far more interoperable, part of that conversation is being expeditionary. And I love our army. They're great Americans, but that's not their job is not to be expeditionary. Their job is when the big war comes, you're pulling up major chunks of Fort Seal really embedded into the fabric of America. You're pulling those people out and sending them overseas, where at the Marine Corps, every, you know, the MUs, the Marine Expeditionary Units, cycle through every hot spot all year, every year, all the time.
Yeah, that's part of what they do.
That's what we do.
Yeah.
So my time at the Navy's International Program Office was also very formidable for me in understanding how we build capacity and capability, not only from a maritime standpoint, but also from how we go in and train other land forces, because mm-hmm. that was part of the Marine Corps' role, and I oversaw that. Another piece that I spent a lot of time working on in a very specific area was building out the Saudi naval expansion program. So building out the Saudis' forces. And that was really informative in a lot of ways. And I guess the biggest way is, I don't think the average American understands how much influence we have. We're a country
that, as a nation, you
as
mean.
A nation.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a lot of people who want instant gratification. So they see, you know, whether you hate Biden or love him, whether you hate Trump or you love him, everybody has an opinion, and we should just tell this person to do X, Y, and Z. In a lot of cases, the national command authority, the president, can do that. But it's choosing those battles. And one of the main reasons that we can drive other countries to make certain decisions is because of our security assistance work or our foreign military sales work that we do. Oftentimes, we will build out entire forces in a country. And what does that do? Well, the beans, bullets, and Band-Aids that flow to support those forces all come from America.
Yeah.
So if we decide to turn the spigot off, then we have that power. We can do that in a lot of cases. And that's not Republican. That's not Democrat. That's how we maintain balance of power across the globe and stop wars. You know, there's always going to be human conflict.
Yeah.
That is, until you change the human condition, that will always exist. But you can take a small war and stop it from becoming a big war. And we have a lot of mechanisms in place from a policy standpoint to do that. So that was a lot of what I did at the Navy's International Program.
Wow. And that strategic alliance is important. And I'm with you. I mean, I'm guilty of saying some of the same things. Hey, look, let's just, you know, make a decision. Let's do X, let's do Y. When really it's a bigger spider web of decisions that have to be made to make sure that the strategic alliances we have stay intact, but also benefit the U.S. I mean, that's just
and
the reality.
Strategic spider web, playing three-dimensional chess.
Mm-hmm. I like that one, three-dimensional chess, yeah.
Well, it is. There's so many moving pieces that what appears to be a very simple or emotional decision when you're Monday morning quarterbacking stuff.
Yeah. We see that a lot, don't we?
Yeah, that happens from time to time, yeah.
Yeah.
But there's so many pieces that are interconnected in these decisions that the government makes on our behalf. And it is a government by the people and for the people. And as much as we'd like to be divided, I'm a firm believer the country is not nearly as divided as when you tune into social media.
Yeah.
I think you turn off social media. I think you turn off CNN and MSNBC. And Fox to a degree, mm-hmm. and you interact with your neighbor, and you'll find out you have 90% in common, and the 10% you don't. Well, it's really not that important.
Yeah,
but it is in reality. Having been there and having worked at the most senior levels of government, I can tell you that there's great Americans working and making decisions, and you can call them bureaucrats. You can call them whatever you want, mm-hmm. but they all go there to make a difference.
Yeah, well, it's a calling.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of those, and I might be totally off base here, but I'll just say this comment. In a lot of those positions, it is a calling because the pay is not near what it could be in the private sector, right? Because, you know,
not
working for
close.
The government, you don't go to make, unless you're in Congress or Senate, you don't go to make millions of dollars. You go to serve,
yeah.
right? Well, and that brings us to the next level of your career.
Yeah, so I did a reasonably decent job with the Navy. And so I got sent off to the Fork and Knife School for general officers. It's
Fork and Knife School.
They've changed the name. It's the War College.
Yeah, the War College.
We have the National War College.
Now, you're a civilian, though.
Yeah. So I'm what would be a senior civilian and a senior executive. At the time I went, I would have been the same. I don't like the rank equivalencies because they're fundamentally different things, but for mm-hmm. lay person, it would have been a colonel moving into kind of a general officer position.
Okay.
So, went to, the War College. It's great work if you can get it. Spent a year, learning about Joe Meany, Clausewitz, civilian control of the military, but really having that refresher course back mm-hmm. from your second, third, fourth, fifth grade civics classes. And then I ended up going to the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Mm. And that was the first time. If you're a big believer in American exceptionalism, if you're a big believer in the Constitution and the Declaration, I can tell your listeners that the civilian control of our military is a very real, very strongly exercised in both the most positive and negative ways you can imagine. Mm. My introductory interaction was walking in to take over India as a senior India desk and being sent literally day two or three to go meet with the CNO, the Chief of Naval Operations, to get him up to speed on what we're doing in India. And
That's a way to baptism by fire.
Yeah. Like I said, day number two or three. And to be clear, I was a nobody, but was speaking on behalf of the secretary, and the CNO was beyond gracious, beyond thoughtful and helpful, and was there to do whatever I asked him to do. Mm. Which is really highlights what I was kind of talking about, the civilian control of our military. When you start hearing things in the media, again, whether you like General Milley or not, you can make a judgment on, everybody gets to make a personal judgment because they're in the public eye. But I can tell you that the service chiefs answer to not only the secretary, but their staffs, and they do it in the most humble servant way that they possibly can. It's frankly impressive that some of these officers that have 20, 30, however many years of experience are really humble servants when it comes time to representing the civilian control that is there. And I've seen it and I've been a part of it. So
wow.
It's breathtaking.
I mean, that's firsthand information. That's not, you know, that's not hearsay. That's great to hear.
Yeah.
It's great to hear.
So I ended up working for Bob Gates when I was in South and Southeast Asia, and ended up moving over to...
And you're stationed there? Are you?
I'm in the building. I'm in the Pentagon at this
okay.
point.
Yep. Okay.
So basically, underneath the Secretary of Defense, there's three or four, I forget, undersecretaries that really drive probably 90, 95% of all the decisions that are made in the building. You have a undersecretary for intelligence. You have an undersecretary for acquisition. You have an undersecretary for personnel and readiness. I think they've elevated the special ops czar to an undersecretary now too. But chiefly,
that's almost a whole nother unit because they're going to do quick reaction stuff, right?
Yeah, they're just trained and equipped in an entirely different manner, and I can go down that rabbit hole. But chiefly amongst those key lieutenants for the secretary is the undersecretary for policy, and at various points in time, the undersecretary for policy has had an amazing amount of sway over the rest of the building and the other undersecretaries. So,
and that's the role you played.
I worked for that individual.
You worked for him.
Yeah, I was a staff member. No, okay. I was definitely not the undersecretary. But what's interesting is, and again, the way things are portrayed on the news are not the way that they actually work in reality. So when you hear the term National Security Council, what What they should be saying is the National Security Council structure. Okay, how we make decisions as a nation as it pertains to our foreign policy and the deployment or employment of military force or covert action or pick something we do overseas. So within that national security structure, you have IPCs, interagency policy committees, which is kind of the staff level working committees to tee up decisional information for deputies committees. Deputies committees make the vast majority. Those are made up of assistant secretaries and undersecretaries, and that's from state, commerce, DOD. DOD is kind of the 800-pound gorilla in those conversations. Principal committees, which is fundamentally everybody but the president, led by whoever the national security advisor is. And then the actual NSC, when you convene an actual NSC meeting, those are far and few in between. Decisions have already been made, and they're mainly put in place for press ops. There's exceptions.
Almost briefings, maybe.
It is mainly for the president to make a dramatic, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. There's exceptions to that, clearly, like the bin Laden raid and some things like that. But by and large, all of those decisions are made way beneath there, just simply because the amount of information and the amount of things that we oversee across the globe, we being the United States government, Secretary Hagel, Secretary Panetta, Secretary Gates, they can't do that. They have to have people in these positions to do it. So
there's not enough time in the day.
There's not enough time in a year. So that was also a very eye-opening part of my life, because I really got to see civilian control of the military in practice. I got to see how decisions are actually made. And, you know, people say if you like sausage, don't go to a sausage making facility because it's kind of ugly. Those decisions are made with the clearest eyes on what is in our national security interest.
Right.
And that can be those can be really uncomfortable conversations for the things that we have to do for the good of the American public.
So you, Southeast Asia.
Yep.
And you went to where?
The Middle East after that.
The Middle East. Okay.
Yeah. Which was kind of
same kind of decisions, but just different audience. Or different types of decisions.
Regions, the way that we make decisions, again, Special Operation Command being a little bit out of that, Special Operations and how we do aid, those are kind of outside. Those are siloed a little bit more than most of our foreign policy decisions. Most of our foreign policy decisions are made geographically.
Okay.
And whether you're at state or whether you're at the Office of the Secretary of Defense for Policy, you're no two region is created the same. It's D&I would be very upset about it. They're not equal, right? South and Southeast Asia is important, and India of that region gets the lion's share of that attention. But when I was there, the Middle East was 75% of the throughput into Secretary of Defense's office.
Wow.
So just from what we have to address in a timely fashion, that part, that region was the lion's share of everyone on the national security apparatus.
In the years you were there, there was a lot of activity.
Were the height of what we were doing in the Middle East and Afghanistan. Yeah. So, so they're not created equal. Now, I would say probably the balance of what those senior individuals deal with is more China related. It's more Pacific oriented, and the Middle East is somewhat contracted.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you go boots on the ground very often when you're working that desk?
There's boots on the ground from a recon standpoint.
For you.
No.
So when you're in Pentagon, you're working that desk. How often do you get over there?
Constantly.
Wow.
Constantly. So that was, rather being involved in foreign military sales or whether you're from a policy perspective, you're constantly traveling.
Yeah.
I can think of no one on the planet that dislikes travel as much as I do.
which brings us to Casey. I mean, you think about the your whole entire life.
Yeah.
You've been in a suitcase.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, I want to brag a little bit on you. Obviously, you know, we've talked about marriage and stuff on this thing before, sure. But you and Case been married a long time.
27 years.
And you've made it through all the suitcase. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, obviously we'll get to Watchtower here in a little bit.
Well, I have to get home tonight first, Skip. So it may be a bad episode. I'm joking. I'm totally joking.
No, look, when you're like me and you're married up, you are who you are because you married a fantastic woman. Yep. That supports you and encourages you and builds you up and supports you. And you know the home front's taken care of.
Yeah.
You know, one of the shows that I'm working on right now, and I'm bird walking, but I want you to know about it. It's called Holding Down the Home Front. Mm-hmm. And what we really are looking for is some special operator, tier one guys, wives, mm-hmm. not them. We don't want to talk about door kicking, you know, whatever. Everybody does those shows.
Yep.
What I want to do is I want to talk to some of the wives because without them, mm-hmm. everything else falls apart. The finances, the kids, the household. You know, it's very important that they get a chance to tell their story mm-hmm. because our military wives, man, are doing so much more than they're getting credit for. Oh, and yeah. And I'm really wanting to do a show on that. So looking for some help out there, guys. If you know some tier one operator wives that would be willing to come on, we want to do two or three at a time, have some feedback back and forth. We want to do three shows, one on the holding down the home, mm-hmm. holding down the finances, and then taking care of the kids.
Yeah.
You know, kids are impacted. You've got two kids, mm-hmm. Which one is obviously following in your footstep, which is exciting.
Yeah.
But you got two kids, and they're impacted by you being gone.
Yeah.
So for having a fantastic wife, it is critical to the success of the marriage, your success in business, which obviously you've got. But you played some really good roles with the Department of Defense.
Yeah, no, it's been a very good ride. It has been super informative. You know, I think when we're off camera, I joked a little bit about, you know, all I wanted to do was get a job at the Pentagon so I could go to the Indiana Jones warehouse.
And about to go there
and find the Ark of the Covenant and find out where the aliens were at. I mean, that was really all I wanted to do. And they made me actually work. So it kind of
sucked. Well, you know, I know where the warehouse is. I can take you if you need to. But speaking of that though, you're right. You have this perception. I'm going to work for the Pentagon. I'm going to be at this high level and I'm going to get all the secrets just poured out to me. They're going to bring me the little leather binder book with all the secrets in it, you know, and you're going to get to open it up and know when were the aliens here? How long have they been here? Who are they?
Who shot Kennedy?
Yeah. Who shot Kennedy? It's in the book. It's in the book. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. I think the American public would be pretty disappointed. I think it's funny. Again, I love to watch podcasts.
Yeah.
It's funny. I find it funny that I'm on one right now. But some of the folks that talk about, whether it's the UFOs or this big secret, mm-hmm. it's almost comical that they've never actually been read into any of the programs that would, if there were UFOs,
yeah,
they would be the last people to know. And
you know why that is, right? They got big mouths. They're not going to tell the politicians.
Well, let's just take something. Let's think about something for a second. And you know, you and I were talking about this off camera. And so
it is a great topic.
When you are actually read into a vast majority of our classified programs, it's disappointing. Because most of it's on the internet. You're literally read into it, so you're bound not mm-hmm. to talk about it, not because you can't go find it.
That's right.
That's the vast majority.
And let's stop there because I just want to make sure everybody understands what you're talking about. When you have a security clearance, mm-hmm. whether it be, and I'm going to mess this up, is it TSCI?
You want me to walk through that?
Yeah, walk through that because I think the audience, it's important for them to know the reason what you just said, the reason you're read in is because you have a clearance and you're bound not to speak on those things.
Right.
So please, just elaborate just a little bit on that because it's important.
It's super simple. And I think, again, there's such a Hollywood, almost narcissistic role that people play when they start talking about this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's very simple. We have confidential information. We have secret information. We have TS information, top secret. And those are different thresholds of There's different thresholds of damaging national security by releasing that information.
Yeah.
Within top secret channels, there is what is known as SCI. It's a caveat it basically says you can be read into sensitive compartmentalized information. Once you have that extra piece, then you can start being read into what is known as SAP programs, special access programs. And they come with all kind of sexy names. And most of them are terribly boring.
They're not near as glamorous as what people think they are they?
Well, they're terribly boring because, you know, you'll get read into, you know, and I'm going to take a walk on the wild side here. We have a Delta Force.
Yes, we do.
And it's like, Colonel, you literally came in here to brief me on Chuck Norris and Lee Marvin. Like, are you shitting me? Now, granted, I'm taking some liberties here, but it's stuff. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of, again, what you could find on the internet. And then there's, you know, there's also there's a bit of song and dance where Congress will kind of put on a show for people. Mm-hmm. So we have what is known as unacknowledged or waived. Unacknowledged is the cool guy term. It's not a real term, but waived special access programs. So the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, can waive notification of those SAP programs to Congress. There's certain rules. Like, they just can't make it up for the hell of it. There's certain rules where, again, I'll go back to the bin Laden raid, where there is a time-sensitive issue, and we will not brief Congress on it. But it's only for a short period of time, mm-hmm. and it's based off of operational necessity.
Yeah, get the operation over with, right. And then you can brief them. Yeah, right. That makes sense.
but even those SAP programs are eventually brief to Congress. So we're talking about time horizons and just the practicality of some of the things that go on. So again, if you're looking to find out where the aliens are, I'm going to sadly tell you, the U.S. government has no clue where they are.
Well, we'll have another conversation. I don't have a security clearance, so I'm good. We can talk about it later. So
brilliant.
Yeah, we'll bring it up. So you moved from DOD, you moved into what I call the big box, warmonger, we talked about this off camera, the industrial war complex, you know, war is a business. Let's not kid anybody. Let's not even think it's not. Yep. War is a business. Yep. You move from DOD to Raytheon.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So ended up leaving the Pentagon and going to work for Raytheon, working in their euphemistically what would be called their Washington operations. Mm-hmm. So running interactions for the company, working with the White House, part of that being the National Security Council, working with the Pentagon, working with State Department, working right. with the Hill. And so did that, I guess, for four or five years. And then the company got bought out by UTC, another large defense contractor. And with the merger of Raytheon and UTC, they became the second largest defense company in the world.
Wow.
And was afforded the opportunity to move down to McKinney, Texas, to help run ISRS, which was at the time Intelligence Surveillance Reconnaissance Systems, $2.7 billion business unit. We did everything from grow integrated circuits at our factories out in Goleta, California, to building the turreted balls that go on Global Hawk. Goes on our Predators, with all the EOIR sensors, the laser designators, you know, on and on and on.
So fun stuff.
Really interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. Super, super interesting. It gave me, you know, as you can tell, I'm a little irreverent about kind of the secrets and all the Washington mystique, and having come from a place where you're seeing this in a day in, day out type of venue, it was interesting to move into a defense company, because the security mechanisms are even more stringent for companies that do national security work than they actually are in the government.
Really?
It's not even comparable. The additional security protocols that we, for good reason, put on those contractors is exponentially larger than what you have to deal with as a government civilian or a military officer. Mm. Yeah. So, did that. And, you know, it was interesting to see how a lot of these ideas are developed, especially having worked with so many of our allies and coalition partners. You know, the country's not doing great right now by any measure. And we, you know, we have these ebbs and flows. You saw it in the 70s. It kind of feels like the 70s right now.
Yeah.
And hopefully we get to the 80s or 90s here soon. But regardless if it's the 70s or regardless if it's right now, America, especially from a STEM standpoint, so science, technology, you know, engineering, mathematics, we are so far in front of the rest of the world. And now I know there's going to be all kind of comments. As soon as that came out of my mouth, yep, your comment section is going to blow up. But the reality is, Russia, China, they steal what we do. They don't do it.
Yeah, that's right. China, everybody knows China's. They reverse engineer it.
They don't have the secret sauce. Mm-hmm. And what was really interesting at my time at Raytheon, especially dealing with engineers, which can be a pretty eye-opening experience, totally different type of personality altogether. But the way they go about developing, all the way back to the schools, the major institutions that are involved in R&D work, mm-hmm, where you have some of the best and brightest minds working side by side without any type of hierarchical structure that you'll find in a China, that you'll find in a Russia. As much as we love India as an ally, they have the same type of problems. So the freedom that we give our engineers to develop research and develop different technologies and how they interact through that university structure is actually unbelievable. Wow. And so the way we develop technology is just, it's unmatched in the world. And it's not something that, frankly, China or Russia could ever catch up with us, because it's cultural and it's institutional, and it's just a byproduct of our open market economy. It's a byproduct of the freedoms we have.
Yeah.
And so when people start talking about eroding freedoms, you know, some of it's, again, it's an ebb and flow of society and based off of world events. But where I get nervous is when we start seeing restrictions placed on our scientific community, because that is one of the most amazing advantages our country has by far. It's there's no country in the world that is even close to us.
Yeah. I just want to give you a couple of minutes to expand on that a little bit. What do you see in restrictions on our engineering and our, what I call entrepreneurial minded engineers that are developing new technology?
Well, I don't know if I necessarily see that. You know, it's not, given what I'm doing now, mm-hmm, it's not something I track closely. My comments were more along the lines of, if we were to ever see that type, yeah, of government overreach. That would be a concern to pop Red Star clusters. Like we have Houston, we have a problem. I guess the place that and it ties in a little bit with my story, with the reason I left Raytheon, DE&I, that type of diversity, inclusion, equity, feel good, take an unqualified person, force them to be in a position that's incredibly important. I see that as a threat in that space. You're already starting to see, we need to have more of pick a color of a person flying aircraft. Mm-hmm. There's no conversation about, are they qualified or not? It's just, we need to shove this round peg in a square hole. And I think if that starts getting pushed into the scientific community, that will be something that could end us.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you see this, I love history. I have the famous newspaper where Saigon falls, and you see the helicopter lifting off of the CIA station on, mm-hmm, the embassy. You can read that, and if you black out Vietnam or Saigon, it reads just like any paper from anything that the left-leaning media wants to put out. Mm-hmm. It's the exact same narrative. It's the end of days. America's in decline. Game over.
Yeah.
We've been in decline.
That's 40 years ago.
Yeah.
50 years ago now. Yeah.
We've been in decline, according to the left-leaning media, for as long as I've been alive.
You know, we just need to stop watching any media at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, really, I mean,
my point in bringing this up is, we're not in decline. That's not, that is a state of mind. That is not a thing. Mm-hmm. But if you start censoring, our scientific community, or you start forcing round pegs and square holes, that would actually be a no kidding measurable, piece of decline.
Yeah. And I believe that we need to invest in our schools to create that ingenuity at a much even more rapid pace.
Right.
So I just want to recap just a little bit. You got a good old Southern Louisiana boy from Moss Bluff.
Yep.
Takes a walk along the wild side in the Marine Corps, goes into recons, you get selected into the recon group, the family.
Dumb luck, good clean living.
Yeah.
Dumb luck.
Okay, dumb luck. Okay, there you go. Obviously, you married up. You go, you work with Coast Guard, you work with Navy, then you go DOD, then you go Raytheon, and now we have Watchtower. So yes. You jump out of the working for the man, working for the industrial military complex, and that's a joke, so yep. don't shoot the messenger. But you jump over here to Watchtower. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back, and we want to talk about Watchtower because I'm really, really excited about Watchtower and what you're doing. Really want to dig into some of your product and really your passion behind it, because that is more to me what we just talked about with the ingenuity and developing that entrepreneurial spirit for the next generation. So thank you guys. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Be looking for this next show. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.